Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Stacey Abrams is a nationally recognized political leader, voting rights advocate, and best-selling author whose new novel, Coded Justice, delivers a mix of legal investigation, political intrigue, and the high-stakes technology shaping our future. Abrams welcomes back former Supreme Court clerk Avery Keen, who's trying to put the past behind her at a prestigious high-end law firm in Washington. As an investigator, she discovers that a groundbreaking algorithm marketed to use advanced AI to revolutionize the medical industry may in fact be concealing dangerous biases. The new book is Coded Justice, and we are delighted to welcome Stacey Abrams to this week's book show. Stacey, thank you so much for being with us. What a treat to have you on the program.
Well, it is my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
For those who may not be aware of the story of, given your very public career, how novel writing and thriller writing came into that mix.
So I started writing fiction very young. I like to joke that when you're a kid, if you tell a story, you're a fibber, but if you write it down, you're an author. And so writing has been a part of my life for a very long time. But in law school, I actually wrote my first thriller. It was supposed to be a spy novel, but at the time, publishers didn't believe women read espionage and that men would read espionage by or about women. So I made my spies fall in love and wrote my first romantic suspense novel. So I've been writing thrillers for more than 20 years. And my first legal thriller with Avery Keen, I actually wrote between 2008 and 2009. But couldn't get it picked up by a publisher, even though by then I'd published 8 novels. The concern was that I was writing about a rogue president and the Supreme Court, and they thought it wasn't really that timely. So 10 years later.
Avery Keen is so much fun to read and such a presence in the book and on the page. I'm curious how this very strong character came about.
When I started writing While Justice Sleeps, the story came about because I was a lawyer who'd begun what my mom calls my trajectory of downward economic mobility. I left being a tax attorney at a big firm and was deputy city attorney for the city of Atlanta and then left that to go and be a state legislator. Luckily for me, there was a partner at my old law firm who would feed me on occasion. So I could remember what I'd left behind. And she was asking me when I was thinking about the next novel I was going to write, she said, well, have you ever thought about writing, a legal thriller? And I said, yeah, but I haven't really figured out the topic. And she said, have you ever thought about the fact that you can remove a president for the 25th Amendment lets you, in theory, remove a president. We cannot reelect someone in Congress, but you cannot remove a federal judge except for high crimes, misdemeanor, or death. Just the complete inability to do the job is not a justification. And I kept thinking about that after lunch. And I thought, what if the judge was in a coma? And Avery Keen became my character because I thought, if you had someone at the pinnacle of power who's completely unable to execute against that power, who would be the best protagonist? And for me, that was Avery. The lowest sort of rung on the legal ladder is a law clerk. And so if you have a Supreme Court justice who could change the future, who's the right foil? And for me, it was this brilliant young lawyer, law clerk, who has this incredible responsibility because she's given his power of attorney, but she doesn't really have any authority. And she has to unravel these clues. And so Avery, for me, was this amazing opportunity to think about the toggling of power and authority. But I wanted her to be smart and sly, but also to make mistakes and be painfully human. And she was just a lot more fun than I realized. And so the more I got to know her, the more I wanted to see her in action.
It seems as though in watching this character grow, but what was there all along is this is a character who seems to be 3 steps ahead of everybody else.
I do try to make certain that she can see around corners, but she can still walk into walls. Because I think when you have characters who are too prescient, it's fun to read them, but you'd never really relate to them. And so, yes, Avery is incredibly smart. She has an eidetic memory. She's extraordinary at pattern recognition. She's not always great with people, and she sometimes misses the cues that she needs to follow. She can be a bit reckless because she grew up having to take care of herself and her mother. And you learn in the first book that her mother is a recovering addict and there are complications to their relationship. And so I want her to be someone you can cheer for, but I also want her to be someone you can worry about. And if your characters are too strong or too omnipotent, there's no fun in that because you know they're going to be fine at the end. Avery, I want you to worry a little bit.
And she has an idealistic streak too, right?
Absolutely. She believes in fact, one of her first major conversations with Justice Wynn, who's the in the first book, he says, are you loyal to me? And she's like, no, I'm loyal to justice. I'm loyal to the law. I'm loyal to the Constitution. And her idealism says that you can believe in a set of values. It doesn't mean you necessarily believe in the people who are supposed to execute against those values. And sometimes we conflate the two. And certainly as a someone in political spaces, I'm well aware of how often we conflate the person and the value system. And the problem is when the person makes mistakes, it makes us question the system itself instead of thinking, how do we solve for the human element instead of discarding the entire, architecture?
So talk a bit how then in this novel she comes in, and just picking up on what you just said of who she's working for and who then she is loyal to, because it gets a little murky.
And that was the goal. So, it was pretty, I wouldn't say black and white, but there was a clear set of good actors and problematic actors in book one. And in book two, she meets sort of her Moriarty and this anti-hero that I create in Rogue Justice. But by the third book, she's adrift. She has to leave being a law clerk. You can't do that forever. She's now at a law firm, and I wanted her to have to grapple with a case where there was no clear right or wrong. And so the person who hires her, former major Rafe Diaz, is this tech genius who has created an AI technology that can provide improved health care to veterans. And he intentionally builds it with DEI in mind because there is no more diverse community in the US that is constructed than our US military. And so he's trying to do good, but AI and human nature will confound the best intentions, not because there is some evil mastermind, but because ambition and arrogance and greed often intersect with technology that is a tool. And right now we're having this national debate about what AI is, and I want us to really grapple with the fact that AI is a tool, and in the hands of people, a tool can either build or it can be used to destroy. But we cannot be so focused on the tool itself that we forget to look at who designed it, who deployed it, and who's managing it.
Stacey Abrams is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new novel is Coded Justice, a thriller. It is published by Doubleday. What is fascinating to me about what you just mentioned and throughout the novel is that, and I used the word murky before, but as you look at this with AI, it does come across that this is a tool. It's hugely powerful, and yet nobody quite seems to know, good, bad, or indifferent, what the hell to do with it.
Which, if you watch television or read anything these days, we don't quite get it. Even the architects, if you talk to Sam Altman, Sam Altman created OpenAI. You've got Mustafa Soleiman, who created DeepMind. You've got Grok, who was created by Elon Musk. You've got Anthropic, which created Claude. They are having very public conversations about how little they actually know and understand what they've created. They're prognosticating about what it could be, and they are guessing with a great deal of, their whole chest about what it should be. But when you probe, you realize that Claude produces a they Anthropic has produced multiple papers about how Claude and other AI tools hallucinate, how they make up answers. You have this debate happening right now between Apple and I think it was OpenAI about whether reasoning models actually work. And so we presume a level of surety from the brilliant technicians, but they don't know. And therefore, I want us as the users and as potentially either the beneficiaries or victims of AI to know enough about it to start asking questions. I don't want all of us to become experts, but we are watching our world really become saturated with AI, and very few of us feel knowledgeable enough to ask questions, and that's dangerous. We should ask questions about tools, to your point, that have this much power.
Tell us about Milo, and the role Milo plays in the story, because there's a few different entities that come around, and then they start to both work together and conflict with one another.
The whole point of this process is that you have multiple versions of AI. And a lot of us are familiar with the chatbots, and that's Milo. But Milo is a chatbot on steroids that were likely manufactured in a lab of great importance. And so Milo is the interface and the helper in this clinic that's supposed to be assisting veterans and really trying to understand the complexity of veterans' healthcare. Milo is trained to be, inquisitive and to be omniscient. Milo believes, or he doesn't believe because Milo's not sentient, but Milo appropriates to itself based on its programming that it might be smarter than its progenitors. And so Milo is kind of the third doctor in the room in this clinic. And the question is, how much is Milo a helper and how much is Milo actually creating both solutions and some of the problems?
To cut to the chase here, in the novel, when there is a death, part of the death investigation, part of the group of people who are being questioned about the death is Milo.
Absolutely. So I like to say, there are people dying. The question is who or what killed them?
Right.
Because you have this technology that, despite not being corporeal or sentient, is extraordinarily powerful.
And they're being interviewed as if human.
So there is this moment of anthropomorphization where they're in this room. So this is one of my favorite scenes to write. Avery and her merry band of friends who are helping her on this case.
Which is a
So
great crew, by the way.
thank you.
Great crew.
So there's her Scooby gang. They have to ask questions and they've talked to all of the humans. And now they've got to talk to the technology. And it is a fascinating thing that it is a very accurate idea that they could inquire. I mean, every time you ask Siri to tell you something, you are anthropomorphizing this chatbot, believing that it can give you information. And we know that in some corners of the world, people are falling in love with AI models. And so, yeah, they have to have this conversation. And these models, these AI tools are imbued with behaviors that don't just mimic, but in some cases mirror and expand on how humans think we operate. And so imagine having to interview not a robot, but interview the compilation of your thoughts floating around and as it aggregates itself, not as you aggregate it. I don't want to meet that version of me personally, but.
No, and no, and you bring up such an interesting point, because one of the things I always have, if I am having a interaction with either a smart speaker or ChatGPT or something, I'll find myself saying please, and I'm like, well, do I need to say please? Do you say please? Do I have to be polite? And I
Yeah.
don't know. I am, but I don't know.
We say please, we say thank you. The question is it because we have anthropomorphized them and we are imbuing them with a sense of our own humanity? Is it just training? But the reality is, when you try not to, it's really, really hard.
Right. And you have to think of it as it's a conscious choice if you don't do it. The other thing that I find fascinating is that in your novel, they know so much about us, about you, about Avery. It's in the equation of not just the facts of the case, as it were, or of what they're being questioned about, but also how her relationship with her mother goes into this, about the car that she has, about all of these things that is in that brain of hers that they find from no other way than just the behavior that she has online.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, if you've ever gone grocery shopping and used your rewards card, if you've given TSA your fingerprints and your retinal scan because you wanted to get through the check-in line 15 minutes faster, if you have stayed at a hotel and ordered food, and if you have watched anything on a streaming service, those are enough data points to aggregate an entire narrative of your life. And then woe betide you if you've ever been to a pharmacy, because now they have your medical history. And we think about these as these individual data points that aren't connected, but all of that data is being scraped and aggregated. And just to add a little bit of both trepidation, but also urgency, in the wake of the DOGE takeover of our federal government, they were able to scrape data from the Social Security Administration, which, if you've ever had to apply for benefits or had to update your information because you changed your last name, all of that data, they have all of your treasury data. So they have everything about anyone who's ever hired you. They have all of the information of every job you've had since the first time you had to fill out that W-9. All of that data is now sitting in some space where they can aggregate not just a profile of you, but a story of you. And the technology we're talking about does nothing but search the internet, scraping data about you, but also being fed by databases you very innocently signed up for because someone at the grocery store said you could save 10% off if you sign up for this card.
What I think is brilliant about the book is that you put it into a medical setting where these questions of life or death come up to the point where the technology is telling the doctors what they should and shouldn't be doing.
And that's part of the caution that I wanted to raise. When you talk about AI in the abstract, or if you're thinking about, do I ask note taker to give me this information? It feels very contained. But AI is deeply embedded in our healthcare. It is being leveraged by insurance companies to decide how they're going to code what your doctor put in and decide if they're going to cover it with your insurance or not. That same technology then is going to be used to tell your doctor what you are entitled to in terms of service. So I wanted to use the medical field for a few reasons. One, I want us to talk about what it means to be sick in this country and to have something that could both help you and harm you. I wanted to talk about the complexity of medical research, which is why I'm such a proponent of DEI. And the reason I use veterans, the first integrated, intentionally integrated portion of our nation, but they also literally are deployed around the world and picking up every parasite they can on the way back. But they also experience the social pathologies of being in America at rates and in ways we don't really talk about. And then you feed all of that into a tool that is not sentient, but that we have imbued with decision-making power. Because if it can decide whether your doctor can get reimbursed for the diagnosis, what's to stop it from being used to make the diagnosis itself? That's a very, very thin line. And we tend to think about it as a gulf, but telling the doctor you can't say that it's multiple myeloma, you have to say it's something else, is not far afield from saying you can only give them this prescription, but not that one. It's just a degree of difference. And AI is very, very much in that business right now.
Coded Justice is the name of the new thriller, and it's by Stacey Abrams. It is published by Doubleday. When it comes to DEI, as you were writing it, was the demise of DEI happening as you were writing it, or was that in the sense of the new administration, or was that something that came after?
It was happening not, I finished the book before the new administration, but I was writing the book during the rise of the attacks. And for me, it was so important to talk about DEI in the context of healthcare because too often it's relegated to some boring seminar you had to sit through or something or some epithet that's been, lobbed about because people don't know what the letters mean. But it was incredibly important to me for us to understand that. And it's been proven by the behavior of this administration. When we hear about eliminating DEI, billions of dollars in medical research has been canceled because it was studying how women react to diseases differently. It was studying haplogroups and therefore the chromosomal differences between where people were born or how or their ancestry, all that genetic data that goes into immunotherapy. Those contracts were canceled. That research was canceled because that's considered DEI. DEI also applies to veterans who are disabled. They are DEI. And if you are a person of color, if you are a woman who is in the military, we have watched women get terminated from the military. We've watched the LGBTQ community get terminated. All of that is DEI. And so part of what I wanted us to do was to take it out of the, 30-second Instagram idea of what DEI is and really understand that for the purposes of this administration, for the purposes of those who are attacking DEI, they mean what I mean. They mean all of it. They mean anything that has helped benefit communities that have been marginalized, disadvantaged, otherwise dispossessed, or who are simply different. And that's pretty much all of us. And so if we let DEI be just about whether Black kids get to go to Harvard, we are doing their work for them. Because when they say DEI, they mean all of the above. And that's incredibly important in this moment because the president issued an executive order saying that if you want to sell AI into the federal government, you can't use DEI, meaning you can't research whether or not a mammogram is an important tool for women because that's DEI, because you're speaking about women, and because women are different from men. You are now using an ideological frame in their minds because you're singling out women. If we can't research women's health care because they are afraid of it, then if you go back to your point about Milo, when that diagnostic is happening and it can't actually consider who you are and understand the complexity of who you are, it shouldn't be allowed to make your medical decisions, which can be life and death.
This is obviously having an impact on who is teaching me, what is in our education, what is in our higher education. And then you throw into this and put it into a world of medicine. And suddenly, while I am the greatest fan of the arts, this is life and death.
Absolutely. Because we have to recognize when you say DEI, diversity means all people. Equity means fair access to opportunity. And in this case, fair access to information. And then inclusion means respect for difference. There's nothing that requires DEI more than medical care because you're treating patients who are entirely different. You and if you, I don't know if you have a brother or not, you may have come
Yes.
from the same parent, but your physical differences are meaningful. And if you have a sister, her differences are meaningful. And so, from the very beginning, anti-DEI in the medical field says that only one of you will ever be seen, and the rest have to guess and hope. And that has never worked well in medicine, and it has never worked well in the US.
What can be done to realize the seriousness of this, that we're not just trying to chalk up political points here, but this is going to have a devastating impact on who we are as creatures, both socially, physically, and mentally.
Having been a politician myself, I tell folks, politicians respond to three things. They're like teenagers. They respond to money, peer pressure, and attention. Part of our responsibility is to draw attention to the consequences of what choices are being made, or to draw attention to choices you don't realize people are making. And so I write these novels. I write with as much fun and intrigue and thrill as I can. But I try to focus on topics that I want people to feel empowered to discuss. Most folks aren't going to go and sit in their state legislator's office or see their congressman and engage in a question about large language models and the algorithmic justice of the AI. But when you read Code of Justice, you're going to feel a little more comfortable saying, I do have the right to ask these questions. I do have the right to call my children's school and ask, do they have a data privacy policy about what they can do with my kids' information? Those are the things we should be asking about. But we should also feel very comfortable asking our doctors, how are you using AI? Not that we should be afraid of it, but we should understand it. And the most effective weapon for a disreputable political figure is the silence of their constituents. And that silence when it's created because the constituent doesn't think that she or he has the right to ask questions. I believe in regulation of AI, not to stifle innovation, but because it's about asking questions. Don't we wish we'd asked a few more questions about the internet before we just let it run amok?
Right.
This is the time to do that.
So as far as your work as a novelist, you get the attention because you get to do interviews like this, and you get to go out
Thank
and you
you.
get to you're welcome, and you get to meet your readers and you get to talk to them. God knows there's no money in being an author. Good luck. So do you still feel that you want to live in a political world and be a political being where you have that peer pressure, you have that, you seek the money to gain the attention to be able to do what you feel is right for your constituents?
I am honored to always be in the political space, even if I'm not in political office, because when you aren't currently an office holder, you get to be a lot louder sometimes, and
Yeah.
people are more willing to listen to you because they don't think you're trying to get anything from it. If I ever stand for office again, I carry with me this framework always that the money should never overwhelm my responsibility for paying attention. And that peer pressure we tend to think of as negative, but there's the positive peer pressure of calling on folks and saying, can you do right by me? And I've just talked to one of your colleagues and she said yes, or he said yes. So peer pressure is not just about how do you make people worry about you. It's how as constituents, can we encourage those who've been elected or appointed to help lead us? How do we encourage them to be on the side of right together? That's a lot more effective sometimes than being mad at them for being on the side of wrong. It's organizing ourselves to encourage them to come on the side of right, even if we have to go and get them and walk them over to the side of right by holding their hands.
Again, the name of the new book is Coded Justice. It's published by Doubleday. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.